or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Adam Bryant writes The Corner Office. It's a feature in the New York Times, and he has been its senior editor, one of its senior editors, deputy national editor, and deputy business editor. He's also the author of two books, one not surprisingly called The Corner Office, and now the sequel, Quick and Nimble, Lessons from Leading CEOs, over 200 of them, from Jeff Weiner at LinkedIn to Angie Hicks of Angie's List, Tony Hsieh of Zappos, and in the nonprofit sector, Amy Gutman, president of the University of Pennsylvania. Adam Bryant, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hi, Marty.
So, I got to tell you that leadership management books, there's been a zillion of them. I get probably literally 50 a year, and they get criticized, perhaps by, I'm just not going to externalize it. I tend to criticize them as well, as being not much more than common sense. Is there anything in your view that isn't common sense that you nonetheless believe is potent advice for leaders and managers?
I do, but I want to say, first of all, that I completely agree with you
about
the books, most books in the kind of leadership and management space. And I think they suffer from the basic problem of truisms, platitudes,
right.
as you say, common sense.
Right.
There's an old Steve Martin riff from a few decades ago where he says, you know, how do you get $1 million and pay no taxes? You know, first get $1 million, and then don't pay tax on it. So, and we see that a lot, just the very simple question that a lot of people set out to answer, which is what leads to success? And they'll say, that's a really good question. They'll go ask 500 successful people, what led to your success? And you're going to get answers that, frankly, aren't surprising at all. They're probably going to be some variation of hard work and perseverance. So,
right.
Again, I agree with you completely. So, to me, the trick and the art is framing the question just right so that it does yield insights that are, you know, a little bit surprising. But more importantly to me, it's sort of setting priorities. You know, if you and I stood at a whiteboard and said, you know, what's culture? We could pretty quickly come up with about 100 things, and all of them would probably be true. But the more interesting question is, well, what are the top 5 or 6 things? What are the things that, if done well, have an outsized positive impact? And if done badly or not at all, have an outsized negative impact? And that's kind of the question I tackled with culture in my second book. In the first book, The Corner Office, you know, I just ask the question, what is it about these people that I'm interviewing that explains why they got to the corner office and why were they promoted over everyone else to the top job, which is a very different and much more specific question than what led to their success. Mm-hmm. What is the qualities they have? What are they in greater abundance than the people one below down? So, again, to me, it's really about framing the question right and then setting the priorities. I mean, there's a parallel in golf. Right. I mean, there's always 100 golf tips that
right.
you can hear, and that gives rise to that, you know, paralysis by analysis phenomenon.
Right.
So you're looking for the, you know, the few things that are going to make a difference.
So before we get to those non-obvious things that both help people rise and then help organizations succeed, there's something that just popped into my head. You know, there is an anomalous effect of gathering your data with on-the-record interviews. I'm a career counselor, and I have the benefit of confidentiality in my office. And the truth is, in there where they're not worried that they're going to get, you know, it's not going to appear in the New York Times, mm-hmm. they can tell me all kinds of nefarious things that really they do to get ahead. Office politics things, various kinds of lack of integrity, all that other crap. Is there a, you know, and so when you list the things that in your on-the-record interviews were revealed, are we creating a tendency to platitude? Because, of course, you're going to say, well, I really communicate well and I believe in integrity and teamwork and collaboration and making everybody feel empowered. You know, is that not a built-in lack of accuracy that accrues from it being on the record?
Well, part of it is the way I do my interviews. I interview people for often 90 minutes. I get the interview transcribed, typically comes back around 13,000 words, and I only print 1,000 words from it. So I'm cutting out all the sort of self-promotional, obvious stuff. And I also do a lot of work up front with the people I interview, and I make clear to them that if they're not going to be candid, open, and honest with me, that we shouldn't do the interview because I'm not going to run it, and that has happened sometimes. So that's one way I avoid that problem. The other thing is that when I'm condensing my interviews, I basically avoid all adjectives, and I'm always just looking for specifics and details because everybody's engaging and charismatic and dynamic and all that. So I immediately cut those out. And I'm looking for, in terms of culture, what they do now, specifics and details, rituals, traditions. But very often, you know, I get your point about the negative stuff, but I get at that by asking them about leadership lessons they've learned over the course of their lives. So that, you know, early management jobs, I ask them about mistakes they made, things they've seen in various jobs over the years. So again, just by setting that sort of bar pretty high up front to do the interview in the first place, and then condensing a lot of it and just throwing out all the obvious stuff, that's how I get to what to me feels authentic, and certainly the feedback I get from readers, you know, they feel that it's very authentic.
May well be. And one more last shot at it. I know there are plenty of people who have risen to the top by orchestrating a very careful plan to destroy the people who they'd be competing with for top jobs. That's not something that anybody's going to admit to you, and yet may be core to getting ahead. You buy that?
Well, in some workplaces, sure. I mean, and we probably all know people who have done that, and you know, gotten to where they are just by climbing over the backs of other people. But you know, I've interviewed more than 300 CEOs. Mm-hmm. I think I'm a pretty good read of people. You talk to somebody for 90 minutes and just ask them open-ended questions about the most important leadership lessons they've learned over the course of their lives and how they hire and the culture they foster, mentors, mistakes they've made. You can develop a sort of 360 sense of somebody. And I'll also say, Marty, that there's probably a bit of self-selection going on that, you know, I get pitched all day long by CEOs who want me to interview them. This is not the typical CEO interview where I'm asking about strategy and the competitive landscape of their industry. We're going to be talking about life and mistakes they've made. And that's also why I sometimes don't run the interviews. And I tell the people at the companies before I sign up the CEO that you need to understand that just because I'm agreeing to do this interview doesn't mean it's going to run. So that kind of sends a powerful message to the CEOs that, you know, if they want to be in corner office, there's got to be a level of authenticity. And, you know, to be honest, over the years, I haven't really gotten many emails from somebody saying, you know what that guy just said this past Sunday? He was lying to you. That hasn't happened, and partly because I do throw out all the adjectives, so it's not such qualitative stuff, but it's more, you know, these are specifics. I worked here. This is what I learned. I had a mentor who told me this. These are the traditions we put in our company on a quarterly basis, and that starts feeling more real than just kind of, you know, somebody puffing themselves up.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Adam Bryant. He writes for the New York Times, and he's the author of two books. First, it was The Corner Office, which is the feature he writes regularly for the Times, and just out, the book called Quick and Nimble. Both really are about what does it take to be a successful CEO, not only individually, but of course the organization as well. So now, with that as a framing, what is something non-obvious that you learned is core to either getting ahead or running an organization that really produces wonderful products and services and creates a good organizational culture?
Well, to take from the first with the corner office, explaining why people get to the top, and one of the five qualities that I identified that really separates these people is what I call passionate curiosity, which is really greater than some of its parts, and I think gets at the kind of relentlessly questioning mind that these CEOs have. And I think that's a bit counterintuitive, because what you often see, the way successful CEOs are portrayed on the covers of glossy business magazines, the whole message is that they have all the answers. They can see the future, they can see around corners. And what I've really come to appreciate is that they know how to ask the right questions, because they can't know everything, and it's that really smart question that can galvanize an organization and move it in new directions. So there's really, they I feel like they kind of present two faces, not necessarily in a negative way, because to shareholders and to customers and to the external world, they do have to, you know, come across as if they have all the answers and can see where the future is going. But they play a very different role inside their organizations, at least the effective CEOs, because, again, they can't know everything, and it's the questions that will move the organization in a new direction. In terms of creating an effective culture, I've really come to appreciate the importance of what I call a simple plan.
Before I get to this, I want to get a response. I was just picturing my listeners right now, and they're listening, and they're saying, incessant curiosity. Oh, my God, I'm always curious about something. I'm always interested in learning the newest thing and finding this. And yet that clearly, it may be necessary, but far from sufficient to becoming a CEO, apart from incessant curiosity. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just watching CNN yesterday, and there was this guy who wrote a book. He said that most CEOs are psychopaths or some sort of delusional in terms of their sense of self-efficacy. And what else have you found, generalizing across those 300 CEOs, is critical, in addition to being incessantly curious, to being becoming a top executive in the nonprofit or for-profit sector?
Sure. Another quality is what I call team smarts, which is just, you know, it's the organizational equivalent of street smarts, and we all know what that means. It's just understanding where the soft levers of power are, having great sense for reading a room, understanding body language in meetings, and getting people to work together. Because, you know, work is changing. It used to be top-down, hierarchical. You report to me so I can order you to do this.
Right.
Work is now being done much more with sort of ad hoc teams that are pulled together from across disciplines.
Right.
And the real test of an executive is, can you get people to do stuff and when those people don't report to you? And that's a point that's been expressed by many of the CEOs I've interviewed. And that takes what I call team smarts. Another one, which kind of...
No, let's go there. Let's stay there for a moment.
Sure.
Team smarts. So, you know, we all know that part of who we are, we have natural talents or lack thereof for certain things. And some things can be developed and some things are natural. Are there any specifics that... in terms of reading people, that my listeners say, oh, good, I want to be better at having that kind of team smarts, reading people better. Anything that is a takeaway that my listeners could use to get better at developing team smarts?
Well, I think the first thing is just awareness because, you know, unless you work at home, most of us work in places where we are involved with teams. And if you agree just sort of at the outset that's important, then it's a matter of watching and observing, and that's the first step for developing team smarts. Is you're sitting in a meeting, why is everybody shutting down as opposed to talking? You go to a different meeting, what is the person who's running the meeting doing differently that is making everybody sort of jump in and contribute and raise their hand and want to talk?
Yeah, I agree with that.
And so, again, I think a lot of it is just, you know, awareness that if these things are important, everything's a mix of, you know, can be learned a little bit innate. But I think awareness is really key. And then if you say, all right, that's important, now I'm going to study that playing out. You know, you watch the people who are rising up, do they have passion and curiosity? Are they asking good questions in meetings as opposed to saying, here's what I think, everybody write down my answer?
I think that is a manifestation of a continuum between narcissism and other directedness. I think that the anybody, whether you're, you know, in a salesman or you're a CEO, the person who's interested in is focusing only on his or her presentation and how clever he is or how attractive or whatever is never going to get ahead really well. It is requiring this balance between focusing, yes, on what you're saying, how you're presenting yourself in style, but also really being out of your head and keeping your audience in mind. Just as like when you write your column, you probably don't just think about what Adam wants to say, but you have your audience at least partially in mind. Is that a fair statement?
It's more than fair, and to me, balance is the key word because I've come to appreciate, you know, I agree with you 100%, I've come to appreciate that almost anything that's difficult in life, you know, to do it well requires some balancing act between two opposing forces, you know, in the same way that everybody's greatest strength can become their weakness, you know, everything is about finding that center point between, you know, humility and confidence. Just go down the list. And that's why I think leadership is so tough, because you've got to be able to hit that balance point between all these different opposing forces. You have to be completely compassionate about the people who work for you, but you also have to be focused on the larger goal, so that if somebody's not pulling their weight, you either, you know, have the difficult conversation with them or fire them if need be. So again, that balance, you've got to have compassion, but you've also got to be tough and keep the broader team and its mission in mind.
Yeah, I want to ask about that toughness in a minute, but I'm going to let our listeners know, again, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Adam Bryant. He's a New York Times writer and author of the Corner Office feature, as well as a book of that title and the brand new book, Quick and Nimble. I think I'm going to invite my listeners, dear, take a shot at this. If you are a leader, an aspiring leader, or you want to present what you're experiencing with your leaders in terms of what's making them successful or not, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. So now let's go to a non-obvious, what, you just said something else interesting. I'm trying to dovetail rather than you ask prepared questions. You said something very interesting. You talked about, you implied that there is this cultural thing that a leader creates where there can be criticism, where it's not just paying attention and listening, but how important would you say it is to create a culture that where criticism is not only expected, but is not reacted to defensively?
I think it's huge. And in my book, Quick and Nimble, I identified, you know, to me, what the six most important drivers of an effective culture are. And one of them I call adult conversations, which is just, you know, we need to talk about something and doing it in a way that leads to a better place rather than the person just getting their back up and becoming defensive. Because most managers in most organizations, I think, literally go out of their way to avoid having these frank discussions, tough conversations, because they're stressful. It can be like stepping into a knife fight in a phone booth, and we'll rationalize away, I've got too much work to do today. Maybe it was just a one-off. If they do it again, I'll talk to them about it. And then they do it a second time, and you say, I'll bring it up in the performance review 9 months from now. And that's when the person's head explodes. And so I think this creates all this sort of what to me is like bad cholesterol in an organization. It just sort of gums up the works when people aren't communicating. You go to the other side. I've talked to a lot of CEOs who just make such an explicit point out of creating a culture where these conversations are, you know, just part of the fabric of the organization. How do they do that? They model the behavior with their own direct reports. They encourage and require their direct reports and even coach them how to have adult conversations with the people under them. I interviewed one CEO where they have a volunteer committee in their company of people who bring in outside experts on how to give people feedback, and then they teach their colleagues. Mm-hmm. So they create that culture where feedback is necessary, but there is an art to it. There are very simple tricks you can use to have an adult conversation where the person isn't sort of shutting down and getting defensive.
Right. So it's stuff like, starting, you know, that's the classic old sandwich technique. You start by praising something about the person, and then you might say something, I might be wrong, but I've noticed that X, and then asking, what do you think? So you've couched it in enough terms which allows the person to save face, yet you've still gotten the feedback out there. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Exactly. There's another great expression called don't go over the net. So, you know, from tennis or volleyball, where, you know, if I'm the manager, I don't say anything that makes assumptions about your motivations and why you do something. I just talk about how I'm perceiving this. So if I say, what I don't say is, Marty, I notice you're showing up 20 minutes late for work every day, and it seems like you don't care. And you're going to say, Adam, that's ridiculous. Of course I care. And you're going to shut down. You're going to be angry. But if I say, Marty, you're showing up 20 minutes late for work every day, it makes me feel like you don't care, then you can't get, you know, that's not going to make you defensive, because you can't argue with how I'm perceiving it. So, again, right, just that simple trick, if you stay on your side of the net.
Yeah. There's another thing that is both mentioned in your book and is I've heard again and again, which makes me roll my eyes, I got to tell you, is, you know, every single leader I have ever met says they encourage smart failures, taking risks, going for the, you know, for something. We learn a lot from our failures. But in the reality, that's usually they don't walk the talk. In the end, if they're, you know, a little failure is nothing. But if you take a big risk, some bold new initiative and whatever, and it blows up, chances are you're going to get fired or certainly your career is going to be stalled. Have you found that to be the case? And if so, what's the antidote?
First of all, I agree with you. And I think we're people are generally really smart and have incredibly sensitive antenna. And they're always picking up signals and they're watching the leadership. And I think as soon as people see a disconnect between what the CEO or the top manager say and what they actually do, I think they pick up on that instantly. And, you know, they sort of say, okay, memo to self, when they say my door is open, they actually don't mean it. And mm-hmm. it can really create a sort of cancer throughout an organization, that cynicism. So I agree with you that it is a pretty rampant problem, but I have heard a lot of CEOs do very specific things around failure. You know, they don't say, you know, let's fail big. They'll do calibrated small experiments, see if they work, so that they're not, you know, betting the company. But just in terms of how they handle them culturally, you hear this expression sometimes where, you know, we need to celebrate failures so that people will take risks. You know, that can feel like an episode from The Office, right, in terms mm-hmm, of mm-hmm. imagining it playing out badly, where they bring in balloons, yay, you made a huge mistake that just cost the company $100 million. That's not how to do it. I talked to one CEO who says at his quarterly town hall meetings, he'll stand up and say, everybody, we tried these three things this month, and they didn't work out as we planned. What I want to do is walk you through how, by doing those things, what we learn from them and how they're informing our, you know, strategy in the next quarter. So that not only provides air cover, because to me that's the expression, right? You want to provide air cover as a leader for the people who tried things and they didn't work out, but to really make explicit the learning process, because you do learn from doing stuff and it doesn't work out. The thing that separates companies is how, you know, first of all, you don't repeat the mistakes. How quickly do you learn from them? And then how well do you incorporate what you learn from it into where you go next? And mm-hmm. to me, that's the X factor. But again, I completely agree with you that a lot of the ways you hear about this stuff feels cartoonish and doesn't feel right.
Yeah. You know, as I'm taking a kind of a meta look at this interview so far, I've been asking disproportionately doubting Thomas type questions. So let me try to restore a measure of balance, to use your term. and let's try to get you out of the pre-recorded, you know, you've done a million interviews. So let's say now Adam Bryant is a new CEO. They decide he's going to, you know, you work for the New York Times. So let's say we, you know, magically you now become the publisher and editor-in-chief of the New York Times.
Uh-huh.
And you now have a chance to create your own culture that's going to be really the best for the Times and best for society. Your obligations are not just to the shareholder, not just to the employees, but ultimately more cosmically to the larger society. What is the first initiative that Adam Bryant would implement if he were the CEO, if you will, of the New York Times?
Well, Marty, I work for the New York Times. I think we're doing pretty well. I'm not sure that would be the best use of my time, because we've got pretty talented people in those roles right now. If you ask me if I went into a troubled competitor,
okay,
I could talk to you.
Fair enough. Troubled competitor, whatever it's going to be.
And let me just say, Marty, I do appreciate your doubting Thomas questions, because I think this field can invite skepticism. So I'm not. I do want to let you know that I welcome those doubting Thomas questions. To me, one of the biggest upsides in any company is to create what I call a simple plan that everybody can understand, where you stand up and say, we are in a very complicated industry, we have a complicated company, but these are the three things that we're going to focus on this year, and this is how we're going to measure them, and we're going to be transparent with everybody on how we're going to get there and measure our success. And the reason I believe that's so important is that I think one of the biggest things that topples great companies is when you get silos developing, mm-hmm. siloed behavior where people in different departments and units and divisions, they all start pursuing their own goals because there isn't that sort of broader sense of we're all in this together. And when you have those silos, people start seeing their colleagues in the same building as them rather than us. And the focus of the organization starts turning inwards, and that's where you get the destructive politics and people fighting for resources. And I think as human beings, we're actually built where we want to work in teams and accomplish things together. And I think I've just seen enough situations, it's been made real to me by the CEOs I've interviewed, where they say, yeah, these are the three things we measure, everybody understands how their work contributes to those things. And by contrast, we've seen plenty of examples of companies that get bigger and bigger, and then they've got all these divisions, and then the structure becomes unwieldy, and you get that siloed behavior. And I keep coming back to that because, to me, that's the difference. If you see your colleagues as us rather than them, that's going to make a huge difference. So, to me, that's one of, you know, the threshold thing is, does the company have a simple plan that everybody can understand? Because I've seen too many situations where, you know, a CEO will stand up and say, I've got 12 things I'm thinking about for us for this year. And at that point, the energy will just drain out of the room.
Yep. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Adam Bryan from the New York Times, author of the book Quick and Nimble, Lessons from Leading CEOs. Phone number, if you would like to have a question or comment for him about management or leadership, either you can complain about your leader or you, if you are the leader, you can get some advice. Phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. What is your question or comment for Adam? Hello, it's you.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi, my name's Melissa. I'm from San Francisco, and this is such an interesting conversation to me. I was wondering if you could almost turn the idea around and think about how a staff can work more effectively to help raise up the executive director or CEO in a company or organization. Sometimes there's a big rift between those two camps, you know, the person who's in charge and leadership, and then the staff who actually goes about enacting what an organization does. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts or comments about that, and I'll take my answer off here. Thank you.
Yeah, that's the managing up question. What do you think, Adam?
Well, I think there's got to be mechanisms for making sure that the people at the top know what is going on at the levels below. Certainly the CEOs that a lot of them that I've talked to, they recognize the ivory tower phenomenon and how everything kind of gets whitewashed and polished to them by the time it gets to them.
Right.
And the smart ones also recognize that there is a lot of managing up. And one CEO in particular said what really makes his head explode is that if he finds out that one of his sort of middle managers is managing up really well, but presenting a completely different type of face mm-hmm. and treating the people differently below them, that can be a really toxic dynamic. So, you know, not every boss wants to hear bad news. And Melissa, I don't know what kind of company you're working at. I hear this a lot from people who email me and others where they are trapped in a situation where they've got a really bad boss and it just brings them to tears. And I completely understand why, because they feel trapped. There's nothing they can really do. So, you know, the first thing is to sort of have the frank discussions with your boss. Again, I think those frank discussions have happened both ways. And I have seen situations where somebody will say to their manager, look, can we have a coffee outside the building and sort of clear the air? And the manager might say, look, I didn't know this. I'm really glad you talked to me. I have seen that happen. From a, you know, more of an organizational, broader sense, it'd be great if there were systems in place to get 360 feedback. And if you don't have that at your company, maybe, you know, send the CEO an anonymous note and say, you know, there are dynamics going on here where you may not be getting the information you want, because they've got to be made aware of that dynamic. Not every CEO is, but they've got to recognize that there's stuff going on that, that they're not hearing because it is being whitewashed.
Yeah. What do you think of the following variation on that theme? You know, it's very easy for a leader. Leaders have to have a certain amount of ego in order to take on all that power. And so if somebody simply writes them that, they're going to perhaps be there may be a tendency to blow it off. But if the letter was not individually signed, and it would be anonymous, but, you know, it says there are this is signed by 9 of your reports, that might create more disequilibrium. What do you think?
I think that's great. I mean, the more that you can create the sense that it's not just some disgruntled employee, it's a better. I mean, I've heard a very similar story from a lot of CEOs when they were young managers, you know, maybe their first management role, that they had mutinies. They had a mutiny on their hands. The people they were managing went to, you know, that then manager's boss and said, "We can't work for this guy anymore." And that was a very powerful lesson for them. And this does happen. And you know, one of the chapters in my first book is called Type A to B, and I believe that to get to the top job, you very much have to be a Type A personality. Mm-hmm. But once you get there, you have to shift to more of a Type B, sort of listening and creating an environment where other people can succeed and not micromanaging. Not everybody can make that shift. I'm the first to admit that, but I've also heard enough kind of authentic detail where I've recognized that, you know, people can make that shift, and I'm just hoping that, you know, for all our listeners out there, that they have more of that sort of Type B person.
I really like, see, there's a good example of a non-obvious thing. That I have never heard before, and it makes a lot of sense to me. To rise, you've got to be very aggressive, kind of Type A, but then in order to really be the kind of manager, the leader who's going to inspire the troops and bring out the best in everybody, you can't be that Type A person. You've got to facilitate others. Love it. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Call, please.
Person is gone. Anyway, okay, well, I'll take this as an opportunity. Now, you know, one of the consensus recommendations about leaders and managers is that you have to attract and retain the best and brightest employees. It's and every leader and manager tries to do that. So why, even at many prestigious organizations, are many employees some combination of underskilled, lazy, interpersonally destructive, or downright stupid?
Well, I guess I would say there are some things you can't change, Marty. What's that expression about stupid is forever? I mean, you know, the person's IQ is what it is. And I guess the second point I would make is kind of a framing is that there is this, you know, thing called the Pareto principle of 80-20 in any organization. You know, 20% of the people are doing 80% of the work. And I think we've seen a lot of that. So there are some things that you can't change. But you mentioned this phrase, interpersonally destructive. I do think that's often the result of bad leadership. And it sort of gets back to this notion of if the company doesn't have a clear sense of where it's going and what it's doing, that creates kind of like a little bit of anarchy and free-for-all. You almost get in a little bit of a Lord of the Flies dynamic, and that's when you get people in different departments working against each other. So much of it goes back to what I think is really basic human behavior. I mean, we operate in small tribes, and that's the way we think, so that even, you know, we may work in a department with a dozen people, and there's another department with a dozen people just down the hall. And even though there are colleagues who work for the same company, there's still that sense of those people are kind of different. Like, I wouldn't have lunch with them.
Yeah.
So,
you know, you're saying it's inevitable that's just human nature, is always going to be 80-20. But in reality, you know, with the employment situation as it is, where the unemployment rate is very unrealistic, I mean, it's, you know, 6.7%, but that's not real. There's millions of people who have been part-time, you know, left the job market. It is a seller's market. If I were, let's just not forget about me, let's say if you were the head of an organization that followed that 80% rule where you had 20% of the people doing 80% of the work, you could easily, like Jack Welch did, drop the top 10%. Probably if you did a really good job of employee screening, which is the thing that I think is the biggest failing of corporate America, they do a lousy job of selection, that you could indeed go from at least 80-20 to 30-70. Do you not buy that?
I completely buy that. And I think the CEOs who are thoughtful about the hiring process, and it's just one example of that. I mean, a lot of companies come up with value statements. And I know it's easy. We can all roll our eyes, right? And it sounds like an episode of The Office.
Right.
Again, but, you know, there are a lot of companies, and I've, you know, 300 interviews later, I've heard enough concrete examples where they sit down and they say, okay, what are the things that are important to us culturally? Then we're going to turn around and use them to hire people. If this is the culture and we want people going to fit in, then we're going to use these as criteria for hiring, and we are going to use them as criteria for firing, and we are going to use them to, you know, give people shout outs and awards at the end of the year. So then it gets much more reinforced. So that's why if somebody isn't fitting into those values, it almost becomes like an organ rejection, and it happens automatically. So I think that's one way to reduce that 80-20 number. The other thing, you know, just in your part of the world, Marty, rather than New York, I really feel like some profound shift is going on, because there is such a supply-demand disequilibrium in terms of talented, you know, software developers and coders, that what I've come to appreciate is that if you are a CEO of a tech company, you have two main jobs. One is to recruit talent, and the other one is to hold on to that talent.
Yep.
And so that's why there is such a premium now. It's forcing CEOs to become much more thoughtful of culture and create an environment that people want to stay, because, you know, again, if you're a coder out in Silicon Valley, you've got a million options. You could start your own company. Everybody's offering you options, a 50-inch monitor, all these things. But it's like, what is it about the culture that makes you want to stay there? And that is, I think tech CEOs think out of the box to begin with, but I think out of necessity, they are doing some pretty creative things in terms of culture. As one very quick example, Phil Libin, the CEO of Evernote, asked his wife, who works at the company, what can we do to help improve retention? And she said, provide house cleaning. So now the company provides free house cleaning twice a month for every single employee. Probably doesn't cost that much in the big picture, but what a retention tool.
Yeah.
So you start hearing things like this.
And keeps them chained. I'm going to be very audacious here, and I'm going to propose, if I were the CEO of an organization, what I would do to attract and retain good people, and you tell me to what extent you buy and don't buy it. I wouldn't worry. I mean, every corporate culture really wants smart, driven, ethical people who have both people skills and technical skills, or at least a balance. There can be a few of the brilliant nerds who can sit off in the corner, but where there's at least a critical mass of people who are going to create a collaborative culture where there's good exchange. So, you know, that's every, you know, to hell with all these strategic planning meetings to create this mission statement. I'm going to say that that a priori is good enough. Then I'm going to go, and I'm going to simply, because I recognize that if I simply place ads, I am really in a minefield, because there is so much lack of integrity in the way people, in their resumes, in their cover letters, and they're all coached for interviewing. So I really rely very heavily on my most trusted employees to recommend new employees. And I don't so much provide cash incentives. I provide more like, we are trying to create the greatest company or nonprofit in the world, and we want only the best people. If you have somebody you think is absolutely awesome, please make that recommendation. Let them join our family.
Yep.
I then use simulations rather than stupid interview questions which you're coaching. I simulate the difficult tasks that would be done on the job and see how well that I would, you know, have my team create, put online an online initial screening that would sample the candidate's ability to handle the difficult tasks, both intellectually as well as social intelligence. Then after that, I have a culture of non-micromanaging, because if I'm hiring all these great people, the last thing they want is to be micromanaged. And so I train my executives to have a light hand, minimal on the accountability and paperwork requirements, maximizing autonomy, but also one size does not fit all. Some people need a lot of structure. Fine, we'll give it to them. But those who don't will not be forced to that foolish consistency. That's my one-minute lecture on how I would create hire and retain great people. What am I missing?
That's pretty good, Marty. I'd say you're hired. No, I mean, all the points that you made out there as you were talking, I was hearing echoes of so many of the different CEOs that do interesting things to implement all those strategies. And, you know, this whole notion of not just recommendations, but one CEO says, he goes around and asks everybody and says, who's the smartest person you know? Who's the smartest? Well, it's like, it's so-and-so, they're in MIT lab or something, but they'd never work here, so don't even ask. But the CEO never lets that go. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, you know, why not? Because his thing is like, I want to hire the smartest person you know. And so that's a way of, like, you know, that point that you made of getting the best people.
Smartest, but also sometimes people can be smart and their intelligence is outweighed by their destructive capabilities in the organization.
Yeah,
if they are disempowering of other people and they have there's like a net effect. What is the probability that this person will add value net? In other words, his intelligence or her intelligence matters a lot, but what is he or she going to bring out the best in others? That has to be weighed against it.
Yes? Yeah, completely. And are they the glue? Are they the kind of person who makes the people around them better? Or are they, you know, rock stars and jerks? And just so many companies have a no rock stars, no jerks rule. But, you know, the point about collaboration, it gets to this notion of self-awareness, which I increasingly believe is the thing that separates people, because so much of work gets done in these small ad hoc teams. And I've seen it myself. If you've got four people brought together working on something, and one of the four people is just a bit off key and can't really read the room and isn't really that good at listening, isn't aware of how they're coming off, those dynamics are so fragile. And so I think self-awareness is just going to be one of those things that grows in importance. And so many of the questions that the CEOs ask job candidates is built around this notion of self-awareness. It's just one quick example. Tony Hsieh of Zappos asked job candidates, he says, Marty, what's the biggest misperception that people have about you? And then there's, you know, you might answer, and turns out that's just a setup. The punchline is, what's the difference between perception and misperception? So it's an interesting screen. You know, it's also a good way to get rid of the people who say, well, a lot of people think I'm a jerk, but I'm actually a nice guy. Well, what's the difference between perception and misperception?
You know, I actually think that a no-jerk rule is a mistake. It is more nuanced than that. Sometimes the jerk who is so brilliant and acts like a know-it-all but really does add so much value that there is room for it. You can't have a company full of jerks because then that destroys the culture. Yeah. But a jerk is kind of like a fine spice in a way. He spices up the action, or she spices up the action. And so you have to weigh what is the likely net impact on your organization of that jerk and then decide.
Yeah, and which gets back to what we were talking about. Everything that's hard is a balance, and you have to get that balance right. And is the person a little too much of a jerk so that that then outweighs the stuff they're adding to the group?
Exactly. We're running out of time, but I want one more question I'd like to ask you. You know, right now, business, and especially its leaders, are under ever more scrutiny under the umbrella of, quote, correcting income inequality. Mm-hmm. And I think back, that's what it's currently called, but a year ago it was the Occupy movement and the 99ers demanding redistribution from the 1%. Now, you've interviewed 300 CEOs. As a result of that, and you're working for the New York Times, which is not exactly a pro-corporate, you know, entity if you look at its editorial pages, etc. Have you become more critical or less critical of CEOs in corporate America as a result of those 300 interviews?
It's interesting because I was a business reporter at the Times through the 1990s before I came in editor and started a corner office. And in the late 90s, I spent several years writing about executive pay and corporate governance and boards of directors. And looking at the world through that prism made me deeply skeptical. And I wrote, it's easy to find them online, I wrote a lot of very critical articles about the structure of executive pay and stock options and a lot of the sort of thinking that underpinned the way the money was played out. I'd say, you know, 14, 15 years later and studying leadership a little more carefully and interviewing these CEOs, I would say this, that if somebody is truly adding value, I think they often earn their pay. They come into a situation, because I've just seen it too many times, there's a troubled company. It's like a football team with a losing season. You bring in a new coach, and they suddenly have a winning season next year. It's because of the coach. All the players are the same. And I've seen, I've heard so many stories from CEOs with very detailed playbooks. Okay, what did you do? You went into the company. You did this, this, and this. And there are patterns there. And those people can add a tremendous amount of value and make a real difference, not just to the investors, but to the employees who work at the company. So I don't have that much of a problem with those kinds of CEOs, because I do feel like they are adding something. Where I think CEOs do themselves a disservice is all these executive pay structures where they essentially get paid a lot of money for showing up in the morning. And there's a lot of games that are played, heads I win, tails you lose, let's move the goalposts so that they get paid either way. And I think that creates a sense of cynicism. So, again, I think my, back to your broader question, I've become more refined in my criticism, I guess, if you will, and also more appreciative of the difference that great leadership can make.
Before I let you go, though, I'm going to take the typical kind of liberal argument, though, against that. So, you know, it's all well and good that a CEO or a vice president or whatever adds value. But, you know, in a world where there is so much poverty, where the gap between the rich and poor is so great, and the CEOs make 500 times as much as the lowest level employee, is that not outrageous? And should there, you know, he's not adding that much value. And part of why he or she is adding so much value is because he or she was born with a silver spoon and ended up going to MIT or Harvard, and that's just an accident of luck. He could have been born in Harlem and, you know, to crack addict parents. And so isn't it a cosmic injustice to pay those CEOs that kind of money? How would you respond?
Well, I think you and I would be talking for the next 3 hours if we take that big a bite at the apple, Marty. But I just think that a reform that would make the difference is holding CEOs more accountable for delivering on their performance before they get paid, that beating the average of their industry, actually adding value as opposed to showing up, and making that the culture of the company and the economy. I think that would, you know, that would provide a small step to, you know, addressing some of these more cosmic questions.
Well, you certainly added value to my dear listeners. Adam Bryant, thanks very much for giving me part of your Sunday. The book is Quick and Nimble, Lessons from Leading CEOs. The full subtitle is Lessons from Leading CEOs on How to Create a Culture of Innovation, but it goes a lot further than that. It really was fun talking with you and hopefully beneficial to all of us. Thanks again, Adam.
Yep, thank you, Marty.
Take care. And now I turn to you, my dear listeners, as, you know, one of the core functions of this show is to do what I call 3-minute workovers. If you or someone you love is struggling, either you could be very successful financially and still struggling, either with a meaning of life or dealing with your boss or dealing with your supervisees, or you are unemployed, you are apps or underemployed, any kind of work-related problem is something I usually like to take, to use his term, a bite at the apple at. This is the time to call before the lines get full. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. The unemployment figures just came out, and the media has been very good, actually, about this. They have looked very cynically, appropriately, at the government-reported statistics that the unemployment rate is down from 7% to 6.7%. But what they have realized is that the major reason for that is because so many people have dropped out of the job market. And if you're not looking, you don't get counted. And if you're working part-time for crappy wages, you're still counted as employed. So what they, and the media has been very good at pointing out the fact that the labor participation rate, that is the percentage of adults who are working right now, is at a 35-year low, hitting that down to 62.8% of people are participating. That is 37.2% are not participating when you count everybody. And the number of people who are not in the labor force has exploded to an all-time high of 91.8 million people. In a population of, I think it's 313 million in the United States, to have 900, and those include children, by the way, 91.8 million working-age Americans are not working, plus others who are working in, you know, these much lower level jobs than they are qualified for or could, would ideally want to get, is pretty scary. And so, you know, they often say the cliche, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and expecting new results. We've had four rounds of quantitative easing, pump printing money to try to get to build the economy. We have created millions of job programs in President Obama's first term. He made a major investment in job creation, especially in infrastructure and in energy and the environment. And yet this month, is just as of Friday, we are seeing, as I said, the worst, the highest percentage of people not participating in the labor force. And as I pointed out last week, we have the one of the best, the most valid statistics is household average income. It is down to the lowest point it's been in 20 years. This is not just, we're not blaming the Obama administration or the Bush administration. This is a long-term downtrend. And so from a macro, I spent, as you know, on this show, I've had a lot of guests trying to talk about what to do about it. I have come away with the conclusion is that, especially in a global economy, that we are, it's going to be inexorable with ever more work that can be sent over the internet, that the average American income, no matter who's president, no matter, you know, whether we cut the amount of employee payroll costs, forgetting about the cost of Obamacare, forget about all of that, we are going to, in a global economy, American average income is going to decline to closer to the world average, which is $18,000 a year. And what that's going to mean is the silver lining is that there is a benefit. The materialistic lifestyle ultimately is not necessarily the most rewarding. I know so many millionaires who have all the square footage in the world, all the Lexuses in the world, all the vacations, all those, and they are miserable. So I really believe that maybe this positive spin I can put on this is that we will learn to realize that the life well led is much more about creative contribution, ethical work, relationships, and not about materialism, and that may ultimately lead to a better society. So I can't deal with the macro very at all. I can propose these larger ideas, but what I can do is help you. I'm going to propose, I've got a bunch of different careers here that I see are growing, at least in over the next 5, 10, 15 years, 15 maybe pushing it, but I want to share those, but I invite you to call if you want a 3-minute workover. If you've got a career problem of any sort, the phone number here, work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134, that's 415-841-4134. The key in my mind to surviving in what is likely a permanently declining American job market is to be under the radar. And so I'm focusing today, as I often do on the show, talking about under the radar careers that everybody is not running to. And thanking I really appreciate my listeners and readers emailing me about this. This came from a guy named Mark Mayfield, who's actually not local. He comes from Iowa. But he's something I never would have known about. He said that the railroading industry is hired more than 11,000 people in 2013. And the president of the American Association of Railroads expects there to be at least that much hiring. It's something nobody would ever think of. We think about, you know, maybe the bullet train, but we don't think about getting hired by the railroads. They hire, you know, not just people who are cleaning railroad tracks, but managers and supervisors and HR people. So there's an example of an under-the-radar industry that you might want to consider. And before we go to the phones, I'm going to give you another example. Like something I have said many times, and this came from an anonymous reader of my blog, so I can't give him or her credit, but he writes, many blue-collar trades people in the boomer generation are retiring. Not many young people are considering the trades because the everyone-to-college mindset turns people off to that, and they still think that they're going to be involved in dirty, dangerous factory work. But there is a whole lot of work. For example, America still is the leader in industrial equipment manufacture. We all, because consumer products are all developed in China and Taiwan or whatever, we tend to think that all products are, but America still remains the leader in industrial equipment manufacture, as well as advanced manufacturing like 3D printing. So going into the field of industrial manufacturing, again, you don't have to be a mechanic. They hire managers. They hire people of all sorts. They hire lawyers. So again, we're going under the radar here. So last time I'll give out the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko for a 3-minute workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hi, it's you.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
So I'm in my 50s, and I had been unemployed for a while, or rather underemployed, but I was fortunate enough to land a job with a social network company.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been so amazed by how many individual people from their homes are doing blogs and making money off of it. And I was wondering if you ever talk about that on your show.
I haven't, because I know there are, I think if I left, I remember reading there's like 25 million bloggers. And I haven't known many of them to directly make money. They use it as kind of a tool to show what their expertise is. But
uh-huh.
The advertising revenues that come off of blogs per se, I have not heard. So tell me a little more. How are you seeing bloggers make money?
Well, also to verify that, I'm reading Daniel Pink's book about To Sell as Human. And he's talking about, we're just not people at the, you know, the car auto dealer selling things. Everyone's persuading in every part of their life. Mm-hmm. And these bloggers are doing the same thing. They're taking a little bit of what I think the Americans have that maybe other countries like China don't have, is our own innate creativity and our perspective and how we really, maybe we're too narcissistic, I don't know, but it goes a long way sometimes, and you need to have that.
But you're telling me, Tim, you say they're making money. Are you talking about bloggers who work for a corporation or a nonprofit?
No, I'm talking about individual people, like moms at home that maybe do canning pickles or something. I mean, that's just an example.
Mm-hmm.
And they get buy-in from advertisers, and they repurpose their content, which is what the word is now, instead
right.
of... You know.
Repurpose means publish it in multiple places. You publish it
exactly.
once on your blog, then you submit it
exactly.
to Home Canning Journal. But you're saying people are making good money doing that. That's something I had not known.
Yeah. I've heard, and I don't know them personally, but I've heard it from people that are in the business, that there are people who have been doing this, and they're making six-figure earnings from advertising subscriptions. Now, they even have staff. You know? So I'm just going to tip off that I'm part of kind of the foodie network. So there's a lot of people doing that, and I just read that Marissa Meyer from Yahoo is starting her own at CES. They were going to be starting their own foodie magazine, if you will. So there's something to be said for that, and there's a lot of, you know, homegrown people out there that have a lot of good things to say, and I don't know how they do it, but they are doing it.
Well, that's remarkable. I do invite all our listeners, you know, to go Google your favorite food item. So let's say you're a nut about scones, you know, or English desserts or whatever, tea cakes or whatever. Go to those websites and see if they really are a lot of advertisers from advertisers that would seem to have the money to pay. So in other words, if, let's say, just taking scones, there are lemon curd, there's a very famous brand that it's crappy stuff, it's called Robertson. Well, if Robertson's curds are advertising on that site, that would tell me that, yes, there's money to be made there. So check that out. I really appreciate that. If you were going to start a blog to make six figures, what would your blog be about?
It would probably be about cooking.
What? But there's a million cooking sites. Well, how would you go about getting advertisers to pay you enough to earn you a six-figure income on a foodie site?
Well, one thing is you have to have really good photography. Photography really sells, and cameras are getting cheaper. So, so you can take some of your artistic appreciation for that, or people that you know that do it, and do a trade or something like that. I'm not quite sure. But going back to Daniel Pink's book, He's talking about how this country is becoming much more freelance.
Absolutely.
Self-employed people.
I know. It's
here to stay.
And I lament that because I just know how many people love the idea of stability and a team environment, and where there's an IT infrastructure and having to be a freelancer is really hard for so many people. I do remember now, I watched a movie about Julia Child, and there was this woman who in parallel was creating a blog in which every day she made one of Julia Child's recipes. Or something like that. So that creates stickiness because every day it's like a continuing saga thing.
Right.
Anyway, I'm looking up at the clock and we are out of time, but I'm glad you called in.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
The suggestion.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, and that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do more 3-minute workovers on callers, and I'll be talking with award-winning science fiction writer and futurist Carl Schroeder on careers and the workplace of 2020 and 2030. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.